Podcast. I'm Anthony Hoff.
I'm Jordan Crook.
I'm Sarah Perez.
And this is the podcast where we run down the latest streaming and entertainment news, and then we do an in-depth review of a new show or movie. This week, we're going to be reviewing season 2 of The Handmaid's Tale, specifically the first couple of episodes, which dropped this week. But first of all, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. It's, I think, a little overdue because you actually do probably more streaming coverage than pretty much anyone at TechCrunch.
Yeah, I picked it up over the past couple of years as I became a cord cutter myself, so I wanted to write about it too.
What cord have you cut exactly? Like, and by that I mean, are you on like Hulu or YouTube? What's your TV setup right now?
Well, the cord I cut was obviously cable TV, but I have Netflix, Hulu, HBO Now, and then I test a bunch of the over the top apps like Sling TV, YouTube TV, AT&T's DirecTV Now, things like that.
Got it. Of the over the top services, which one do you think is like the most promising for your average consumer?
I still like Sling TV just because I've been using it the longest, I guess. It's a little dated, but it kind of depends on what you're looking for. And, you know, I'm not a huge sports person, so it's not super important to me, you know, which one has which games or whatever. But I really like the YouTube TV interface these days. I think it's really like young and fresh and super simple to use. But I feel like the content's a little bit more limited. Like there's a lot of times I'll look for a show and it's not on YouTube TV.
We've talked about that before. You really like YouTube TV interface. I like Hulu's, but you think Hulu's is trash.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to call it trash. I'm getting more used to it over time. But I feel like it's very there's too many steps to get to certain parts of the interface that you want to get to. Like if you want to just read the synopsis of an episode, for example, you know, you have to click, you know, go into details, then you have to click into the episode. And it's just not as streamlined as I'd like it to be. And I also don't like the part where it shows you like kind of what they're promoting, basically. Like I'd rather just line up,
I think is what it's called.
Yeah, line up. I don't really care what they're promoting. I want it more personalized to just what I want to watch. And, you know, I put that stuff in my, you know, my stuff and my, and I like the continue watching so I can easily hop back into what I'm streaming, but I don't really like the sort of advertorial nature of the lineup.
Okay. Well, I think that we've all established that Sarah knows way more about all of this than we do. So why don't we move on to our first piece of news?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is actually a story that you wrote, Jordan, which is basically just all the content that Netflix is putting out in May, which, I mean, I think is always just a really large amount of just, you know, and there's usually a couple of like really, you know, like high profile releases, like next month we've got a new season of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, a new season of Dear White People. But then there tends to be just a lot of things where you look at the list and you're like, what is that? What?
Yeah. And some of the stuff is like, there's one of them here that's like season 4, I think. It was Inspector Gadget. I can't imagine that Inspector Gadget's been around for that long to have season 4.
Inspector Gadget? The
but cartoon? I guess it has. I don't know. There's like Spirit Riding Free season 5. You guys know what Spirit Riding Free is? Like, how did they get to 5 seasons? I'm just, I was writing it and was just like, what is this? But, yeah, shockingly, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, there's like 2 or 3 less titles coming out in May than there were in April. So, like, it's just it's a blitz from Netflix right now. Just everything and anything. There are a couple stand-up specials that I'm excited about for May. John Mulaney is probably going to be good. Tig Notaro is coming out in May as well. Happy to Be Here should be pretty funny. There's we talked about Terrace House a couple weeks ago for Daryl's last show, RIP Daryl. And that, like, the second part of that season is coming out. Terrace House Opening New Doors Part 2 on May 22nd. So that should be exciting. And there's a there's a comedy special with Steve Martin and Martin Short, which should be just amazing based on who those people are. So lots of good stuff coming. I'm really excited about Dear White People probably the most.
Yeah, I like that show. I thought the first season was really fresh and funny and just, you know, it's talking about important stuff, but it's not doing it in an in-your-face way. So I thought it was really relatable, even, you know, for anyone.
Yeah, is there anything else that you're particularly excited about?
The show I'm watching right now is The Expanse, and it's only a couple episodes in, so I've been very excited that it's back, the season three. It's probably the best sci-fi show I've seen since Battlestar Galactica, honestly.
Battlestar Galactica.
Me and Jordan both really love Battlestar Galactica.
I'm obsessed with it.
I know some people have read the books as well, and it's really just great to see it come on screen. I know you're a big sci-fi reader. Did you ever get into this?
I saw a few episodes because they did like a special screening in New York at the Alamo Drafthouse, but I actually haven't picked it up yet. I'm hoping to sometime in the next month or two. But yeah, I've basically seen a couple random episodes, but haven't really gotten into it. I've heard a lot of people say it's probably the best science fiction show on television. And so that's on both the Sci-Fi Network. And then it also, I think, comes to Amazon Prime once the season's done, right?
Are old seasons on Amazon Prime right now?
Yeah. So you can go on, I think, watch the first two seasons.
Oh, that's cool. I'm due for a really... I mean, well, there could be arguments about Lost in Space versus Expanse. I haven't seen Expanse, so I don't know. And I know that the books have, like, an incredible following. Matt Burns right now is deep in the weeds on the Expanse books. And I've heard really good stuff about that. Have you seen any Lost in Space, Sarah?
No, I was going to maybe pick that up next as well. I heard that was good. I was kind of waiting to see what people were saying because it seemed like it could be either really campy or like fun.
It's both. You know? It's both so in it's the best way. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's like kind of like it hits your heartstrings in a very like real way. And like the anxiety you feel in like stressful situations is like super pure, but it's also can be like a little campy. But it's great. It's like good family viewing, I think.
I was going to say, is it kid friendly and like what ages?
It's kid friendly. I don't know about ages given that I don't know anything about children. But like I would say like my guess would be like 8, 9, 10 are going to be okay. Fine with it. It might be like a little too scary for like a 5 or 6 year old, you know?
Right.
Just like not scary as in like gory or horror-y, just like stressful situations, you know,
right?
Like, but there's no like cursing from what I remember. If there is, right. It's like light, you know, there's no like f-bombs or anything. It's good family viewing, I think.
Good. That's something that I found is really hard to locate are shows that you can kind of watch with your children. It used to be that there was, you know, blocks of programming, like remember TGIF back in the day?
Yeah.
You know, where you could watch a show and with your kids, and there's not that many out there these days. It's all very either adult-oriented or very kid-oriented and nothing kind of in that middle ground.
I think this is a good one to watch with kids because it's like, one, it stars three kids, you know, like the youngest main character is 11, I think. And he's like a little genius. So it has kids in it and has like good kind of role models for kids, and then at the same time it's like the problems that they run into or the obstacles that they have to overcome are like intense enough for an adult to, you know, feel some sense of like accomplishment when it's resolved. Like there's still serious adult situations that they're in, adult being like, you know, life or death, but not necessarily like sexy or anything. But it's, like, not so much that kids are, like, oh, you know, like, having, like, nightmares, I don't think, you know?
Perfect.
So I think it's a good one. Anyways, we got a little bit on a tangent. I just have to say, before we move on to the next piece of news, I left out, like, potentially the most important piece of stand-up, which is Ali Wong.
I agree.
Coming out with a new one, Hard Knock Wife. I cannot wait, man. I cannot wait. Her most recent stand-up special on Netflix is so funny and iconic. It's perfect, and I can't wait for her next
one. Oh, was she the one who did it pregnant?
Yeah, she did it pregnant.
And
she
was like, I like her.
I forget
yeah.
what she said. There was some joke about like how like I don't wanna lean in. I wanna lay down. Oh, I love her. Yeah, so I'm excited about Hard Knock Wife. That should be funny. And like a lot of her last stand-up was about her husband, like meeting him, and like how their relationship kind of developed. And I'm excited to, with the title like Hard Knock Wife, I'm excited to hear what she has to say this time. So what are we moving on to? CBS?
Yeah, so Sarah, you wrote a story this week about CBS All Access and how it's basically expanding beyond the U.S., although with this pretty crazy caveat that this Canadian version will not include Star Trek Discovery.
I know, right? Well, they sold the rights, the international rights to that show already, I guess. So, I mean, they're going to make money from it regardless. It's just without the flagship title, though, you kind of have to wonder whether Canadians are going to be that interested in signing up for a CBS service.
Because it's basically existing CBS shows, which you can get, you know, on regular CBS, non-pay CBS, although this has the sort of on-demand library, and then The Good Fight. And that's basically what you're paying for.
Yeah, well, I guess the difference is also that the service also lets you watch live programming.
Oh, it does, CBS. Okay.
So that's a little bit of a differentiator between something like Netflix and the CBS service. Which is useful if you want to watch your local news or, you know, the game, whatever. I'm not sure exactly how the live feeds will work in Canada. I guess we'll have to take a look at that when it actually goes live.
Do you have a sense of, like, I mean, obviously CBS likes to, when things are going well, they'll sort of, you know, put out some of these, like, vanity metrics. Like, Star Trek Discovery was, like, their biggest sign-up day ever because... Of course it was. How could it not be? Do you have a sense in general, just like how do you think it's actually going pretty well for them?
Well, I think that it's going better than I would have expected for a CBS streaming service of all things, especially in a market where people are already spending on Netflix and sometimes Hulu and, you know, when Game of Thrones is on HBO. They like to combine their metrics with Showtime's metrics, though, so it kind of makes them look better than if it was CBS's metrics alone. But, you know, sometimes all it does take to get something off the ground is one really good show. I think that HBO has wildly benefited from, you know, Game of Thrones. Star Trek Discovery is not Game of Thrones, like, I'll admit, but I don't know if HBO would even have as many subscribers if they didn't have such a big following for that one show. And I think CBS was kind of betting the farm that Star Trek was going to go really well. So I still think it's going to be difficult for them, you know, long term as the market gets more and more fragmented and there's so many streaming services out there to maintain a following even when, you know, Star Trek is off the air or Star Trek ends at some point or it just becomes less popular. People get tired of it, want to watch something else if they don't keep coming up with other big titles that can draw an audience.
Yeah, because I mean, I think that HBO, at least, they've sort of talked about the idea that they're reasonably comfortable with the idea of some degree of churn when people just sign up for Game of Thrones. And then, obviously, some of them will stick around, and some of them, once the season ends, will go away and maybe come back when the show comes back. And I will say that, you know, I think I've been pretty transparent about I signed up for CBS All Access for Star Trek, and as soon as that first season of Star Trek ended, I canceled my subscription, and maybe I'll come back when the new season comes back. But I'm just saying, like, I think a lot of these networks, I mean, obviously the HBO and CBS business model are slightly different, but they're comfortable with the idea that, hey, we'll draw people in with a big show, and then some of them will stick around, some of them may, you know, go away and then come back, and that is just built into our model to an extent, at least.
Right, right. Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of people will do what you're doing, which is drop the show for time period while the show is off the air and rejoin when the service is that brings the show back. But the real challenge will be to have enough programming in the app to keep people from, you know, discontinuing their subscription when the show's gone.
Right. You don't want everyone to do what I'm doing.
Yeah. No, no, definitely not. I mean, CBS does have some mainstream shows like Big Bang Theory, and I guess there's some people out there who want to stream that. I just don't know, but I have a feeling that the people who are watching Big Bang Theory still have, like, cable TV subscriptions.
Yeah, that seems like the kind of show, and I mean, I have not seen a lot of Big Bang Theory, but the kind of show that you watch when it's on, and, you know, but you're not necessarily, it's not like appointment viewing.
Right, yeah, it's, yeah. And it's also just not, I don't know, it just doesn't feel like an over-the-top service show, which it just feels like a classic show from another era of television.
Exactly.
I've kind of checked out because you guys were talking about Star Trek and CBS.
You can continue checking out because now we're going to move on to superheroes, which is just, wanted to mention that I went to a press screening earlier this week of Avengers Infinity War, which opens this weekend. Some of our listeners, you know, the hardcore superhero fans have probably seen it already because there were some screenings on Thursday night. But it is a very good movie. I recommend it. Maybe it's not quite as good as I was hoping. And I think the other thing to note, though, is that we were talking, you know, when Black Panther came out, about this idea of, you know, that the Black Panther is a movie that you can see even if you've not watched any of the other Marvel movies. And in fact, probably a lot that was true of a lot of people because you just look at how much money it made. I think Infinity War is also going to just make an insane amount of money. But in some ways, it's the opposite because it's really designed for the person who's seen all of the other films. And there's just long stretches of it where it's just like, hey, here's a character from two movies ago. Hey, here's another character from three movies ago. And it's just this sort of like, if you're like the person who gets excited about that, I think it's great. But if you're that makes you sound tired, you may not love it.
Yeah. Do you think there's like some like fatigue with all these movies coming out?
I think there will be eventually. I think Marvel is the one company that where that hasn't really set in and all. They continue to be insanely successful. But I think they're being smart that they realize that can't go on forever. And so Infinity War and then the next Avengers movie, which is coming out next year, they haven't announced the title for that yet, I think are meant to sort of draw this sort of section of this period of superhero films to a close. And then I think, you know, obviously a lot of the characters will continue into the sort of next phase. But it does feel like Infinity War is probably about as big and, you know, overstuffed a superhero as you can make without, like, it becoming completely incomprehensible.
So you think I should go see it, even though I don't care?
You could probably skip. I mean, if all your friends are talking about it, you may want to go see it. But, and, you know, I think you'll probably, I think it's just objectively not as good as Black Panther. I also just think that there'll probably be sections of it where you're like, I don't know who any of these people are. But it'll still be fun. It's like, I mean, it's still, they spent a ton of money on it. All the actors and characters are really talented, are interesting and talented. And so it's not a bad movie. It's definitely a good movie. It's just, I think it's interesting that you've got, within a few month period, these two very different kinds of Marvel movies.
What character does ScarJo play?
She plays Black Widow.
Is that a good one?
Yeah, she's been in a lot of the previous films. She hasn't gotten to headline her own movie yet, which I think a lot of people sort of think is bullshit, which it is. It's totally bullshit.
It's bullshit, man. All right, well, good for Avengers Infinity War. I know a lot of people are excited about it. I've been seeing on my Twitter, like, you know, don't spoil Infinity War. Please don't spoil Avengers Infinity War. I'm going to see it tonight. So I probably have a really cool following on Twitter, is what that means.
Don't sound so excited.
Sarah, are you excited for this movie at all? Are you going to go see it?
Who, me? I'll probably watch it on the plane later at some point.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not a huge superhero, yeah, movie fan. Sorry.
You're outnumbered this time, Anthony.
I would say, like, if you have like Movie Pass or something like that, it's also worth seeing on a big screen because they clearly spent, you know, some crazy amount of money on it too. So it looks great on a big screen.
Yeah, anything I do out of the house costs me $10 an hour, so I usually don't go to movies. I just go do other fun things.
Something costs you $10 an hour?
To leave my house, yeah, yeah.
For babysitting.
Right, it's really got to be worth it.
So, yeah, movies don't quite rank up there. I will go for, like, movies I really, really want to see, but superhero movies just don't meet that bar usually.
Or during, like, a Josie play date or something, maybe.
Yeah, I'll just leave my 8-year-old home alone while I go to the movies.
No, a play date, like when she's out with her
oh,
friends.
Yeah, drop her off somewhere.
She's out on the town, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that happens occasionally, but modern-day parenting is not usually a drop-off play date situation. It's a make friends with the parents, hang out with the parents, play date with the parents.
That sounds terrible. I'm never. That's another reason not to have kids.
Yeah.
I don't want any new friends.
Yeah, earlier you were like, if all your friends are seeing it, and I was like, man, that's generous. I'm pretty sure I've got a girlfriend and a little sister. That's about it. neither of which I think are interested. But let's get on to something that I'm definitely interested in. Highly, highly interested in. Handmaid's Tale Season 2 came out. Two episodes came out on Wednesday, I think. And I've flew through them. And a few more on the screener site, honestly, if we're being honest. I watched past probably where I wish I had watched, because now other people are going to be watching it and I'll have already seen it and I'm just on the wrong pace. But
right. So we're going to talk about this we're going to try to keep this relatively spoiler free. So if you haven't watched the two episodes yet, you should be safe unless you just want to be completely blank. And then maybe towards the end of this, we might start to get a little bit more into spoilers. But so it's, I assume both of you were fans of Handmaid's Tale before.
Yes.
Yes.
I am going to quickly, just for those of you who are completely out of the loop and don't really mind getting a brief rundown on what happened in season one, the spoiler-free stuff that you can't have seen a trailer for your Handmaid's Tale without knowing is that they're in this sort of dystopic future world where, like, what we would consider the religious right, I guess, like highly conservative, men are in charge, women are subservient, kind of regime has taken over the U.S. And part of the reason that happened is because women are no longer bearing children at the rate that, you know, people want it to be. There's a concern over losing the population. And so women who are fertile and can have babies are called handmaids, and they are impregnated by the men, the powerful men, to have babies, and they have to give their baby up. And it's just really just fucked up. It's like 100% fucked up. And that's kind of season one's exposition. We have like a main character. Her name is June. Her name in that regime is Offred of Fred. And we end season one not really knowing what her fate is. And then season two opens up and we have these first two episodes. My general first reaction is that it might be like gratuitously gory a little bit. More so than the first season. But just as good. And we have to remember they're like going away from... They had Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale for the first season as a blueprint to kind of lead them through the story, and this is the first time they're going off book. And I think it's doing a pretty good job of staying kind of within the world that was originally created and set up and expanding that world. But what did you guys think of the first couple episodes?
Well I think it is definitely, I agree with you, more gory. I wouldn't say gory maybe, but just more misery and more horrible things, whether it's, you know, hangings or torture or even mental abuse, as is common in their attempts to brainwash the handmaids and subject them. I find that it's both one of the most amazing pieces of television and just a completely miserable experience to watch it, to where you almost do have to talk about it afterwards just to kind of get that out of your system, because it's just so grueling to get through. And even with this assignment of like, let's watch The Handmaid's Tale and discuss it on this podcast, it just kind of like weighed on me knowing that I was going to have to turn it on at night after watching the news all day and then kind of get immersed into this horrible, horrific like world where nothing is good. There's no hope. And I like a good dystopian drama as much as the next person, honestly. But I feel like the one thing that it lacks, and I mean, this is the source material, I suppose, but there seems to be no exit. There's no hope. There's no, seemingly no chance that anyone could ever topple this regime. Though I believe the end of the book implies that at some point it did, that did happen. So I would love to see some signs that a resistance movement is going to eventually be able to uprise. And I'm not seeing that at all. It's just every single scene, if when you're watching, it's like, what is the worst possible thing that could happen in this scene? Everyone dies? Okay, here you go. You know, like that's how it feels like when you're watching a scene. And when it doesn't happen, you're almost shocked that, you know, it's just like, what? Really? Not everyone died in this scene? It's hard.
Definitely a grueling experience. And, you know, like the Handmaid's Tale, the first season came shortly after Donald Trump took office. And I think it kind of hit this zeitgeist type, you know, moment where it was the fear of like kind of conservatism or nationalism, kind of like that insular viewpoint was really like brought to a head. Like it was taken to its furthest extreme with The Handmaid's Tale, like what that could end up looking like in a worst case scenario. And I feel like with season two, not that that fear has died down at all, like culturally, but I feel a little bit like they are kind of wading through it and not, it's not necessarily taking advantage of what's happening today for us in the real world as much in season two as I feel like it was maybe in season one. Does that make sense at all?
Right. It doesn't feel, which is interesting because actually season one, from what I understand, was written and mostly, you know, filmed. It was basically made before Donald Trump's election. So it wasn't,
like a happy accident.
Right. Exactly. And I think you're right that it becomes more sort of about the plot and the characters as opposed to trying to draw a ton of real world parallels. But I do think like one exception is, you know, that I mean, in general, there. So the part of the structure of the show is to have, you know, most of it takes place in this dystopian future, but then they continue to do these flashbacks to the characters basically right at the transition point where it went from a world that was recognizably our world into The Handmaid's Tale future. And to me, those are almost always like the tensest and like toughest things to watch because you there has that feeling of like, oh my God, this is a thing that could become real.
Yeah, it like grounds you back in reality, for sure.
I don't know.
let me just make one point, and then we can talk maybe more broadly about the flashbacks. But to Jordan's point about the political resonances, there was that scene that takes place in an airport.
Yeah, that's exactly what my mind went to when you were talking about this.
And there are these officers who are both like police, but also like ICE officers. And so I think that one felt to me like a very sort of conscious, you know, given I think a lot of the headlines are out like immigration and particularly like the way that ICE has been treating a lot of people. It felt very like present and like contemporary.
Yeah, I agree.
Sorry, Sarah, you were saying something about the flashbacks.
Yeah, the flashbacks, I think those are, I mean, I do agree that they're the most, the scariest part because you're like, well, yeah, one law change and this could happen. Our rights could be, you know, slowly rewound. But I think that in our society, what we're seeing is when things happen, we're seeing mass protests in the streets, you know, we're seeing elections where people are voting in new choices into office. And we also have a democracy that's set up with checks and balances. So even though we don't like some of the things that our president is doing, like judges are overturning those rulings. And, you know, so the only way that that system really came into power was not be, you know, was not all these little things. That was a part of it. But they showed in the flashbacks how they, you know, took over the government through acts of terrorism. And I won't go into details to keep it spoiler
free. Well, I think that was also mentioned in season one as well. So I don't think that's a huge spoiler. But
okay, I couldn't remember. But yeah, so they were, you know, bombing the White House and, you know, taking over and killing a bunch of people, basically. But I feel like in our society, if like a terrorist group did something like that, we still have a standing army, a massive standing army with tanks and nuclear weapons. And I don't think that a terrorist group could take over our country, you know, a domestic terrorist group, take over our country that easily as it's shown in The Handmaid's Tale. I mean, it's fiction and you just buy into it and that's fine. But that's the only part of the world, you know, that it goes basically overnight from somewhat of a modern society to a completely, you know, completely different.
Yeah, I think like, you know, it's hard to like determine like, oh, to what extent would it take for a group to, you know, overthrow, because it depends what that group is, right? It doesn't necessarily have to feel like a terrorist group. And it probably is a waste of time to even go into it, honestly. But I think the thing about The Handmaid's Tale that it actually makes it hard to binge, which I think is interesting, right? Like, these shows are made to binge. Hulu has a bit of a different strategy with it. They, for season one, they announced released three episodes initially alongside the launch of Hulu Live. I thought it was a brilliant strategy at the time, still do. And then they released one a week on Wednesday night. And with this season, they released two episodes, and then they're going to do the one weekly, which is interesting because the show really is very hard to binge. It's exhausting to watch. And I think part of that is because it's really great television, and you feel every single moment, whether it's from the cinematography or the music or the actual the plot, the words, whatever it might be, it's like you feel like you almost can't escape as a viewer too. And then the other part of that is because I do think that there are moments where it hits home, you know, semantics aside of how quickly that our world could turn into that world. There are touchstones and there are moments in the show where you feel the cultural surroundings that we're in mixed with that kind of worst case scenario that really, I think, can scare someone. It scares me for sure. The particular airport scene you're talking about, yes, ICE makes it a little bit more familiar and relevant. But for me, you know, that really hit home in a lot of ways. It was essentially, you know, like a personal kind of touchstone for me. And I was like, oh man, like if that happened, I don't know what I would do. You know, like it really hurts. And I think the people can relate to a bunch of different parts of this, you know, and find kind of their own worst case scenario, you know?
Yeah, with a turn of a law, you know, papers like the marriage document that was presented, you could just become invalid. And I know that women today are also worried that, you know, Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned, you know, just because of who we have in office. And I think those are very real concerns. But like you said, The Handmaid's Tale is like the worst case scenario on every single front. Like if they all happened at the same time, that's what it would take to create this new world where everyone's rights have been destroyed, basically.
Going back to that point about binging, I mean, that's definitely true. And I think one of the reasons why Hulu has been successful at sort of establishing this non-drop every episode model is because The Handmaid's Tale is such a great example of a show that you don't want to like just binge entirely in one weekend. I do get the sense that I think this was true towards the end of season one and now into season two, is this that it actually becomes a little bit more bingeable because there's more plot. Whereas in the first few episodes in particular, I thought it was just really like every episode I would just like immediately want to stop watching because it was just like, let us show you this horrible, horrible world. And now there is an, you know, like following June's story, that there's a direction to it. And so even though things are still incredibly bleak, I'm more likely to want to watch the next episode rather than just like turn it off as soon as like one episode is over.
Yeah, there's a bit of like wanting to know what's going to happen to her next, because she is kind of on an adventure of sorts in the beginning of the season, as she's trying to escape the regime and maybe get to Canada or something. So you do kind of want to know, does she make it? Does she not make it? What happens along the way? And that sort of thing.
Well, I think certain episodes are harder to binge after than others. Like, I will say, for those of you who have not yet tuned into season two, the first episode, I've seen four episodes. And the first episode thus far is the hardest one to watch. You will probably need a break before you jump right into episode two, unless you're, you know,
glutton
more
for punishment.
Thick-skinned than me. Yeah. that first episode really, man, it comes in hot for sure. And there is a lot of upsetting things that you see that you wish maybe you didn't see. But to the right ends, I believe, you know, like the... It's really, I think, in a lot of ways, from what I've seen so far, season two is two things. The first is expanding the world, and as part of expanding the world and the people you view and, you know, kind of what is happening on a grander scale, the stakes are also raised, right? And that means, you know, you really understand the weight of each of these decisions, the punishments and the kind of consequences have not been as high stakes as they are right now, which is very scary and adds a lot of tension to it. The second thing is about kind of Offred/June understanding, like seeing more depth to who she is and her past and how she makes these decisions. Because I feel like in season one, she was very much, you know, kind of the victim turning superhero. And that was just those two sides. And now we're seeing how she can be both a victim, you know, a good mom, a bad mom, a good friend, a bad friend, a survivor, kind of a bitch. You know, she can be a bunch of different things, and we're expanding her as well, which I think is a great direction for the show to go in for season two.
Yeah, she's not just, you know, she wasn't necessarily just a good person in the past, however you want to define that. I mean, she was an adulteress of sorts, or I guess a mistress, you know, before she ended up marrying and having a child with Luke. And she had they reveal that her relationship with her mother, and she wasn't, you know, it wasn't perfect, let's say. But so she comes across as more of a real person as opposed to, you know, just a put upon victim who's now gonna, you know, fight back or something like that. So it makes her more relatable because you're like, that could be me. That could be anyone.
Yeah.
Can we also talk about how Rory Gilmore can act? Oh my gosh. She's doing great. Alexis, what is her name?
Bledel.
Yeah, she's amazing. And I thought she was one of the best things about the first season, too. Like, because when you guys were talking about, like, how gory the second season is or violent, and I think that's true. But I think still for me, like, the most difficult to watch part of the show was actually the sequence kind of fairly early on, I think in the third episode, which kind of shows what happens to the Alexis Bledel character when it, you know, it's revealed that she's lesbian, and there's this very long sequence which shows what happens to her lover and then shows what happens to her. And it is, I mean, I'm still like scarred by that, because I mean, they don't show a lot, but
even that they don't. Yeah, exactly. They don't show it. Like you feel all of the weight of what happened and the aftermath and all of that, but you don't actually see on screen what happened. You know what I mean? Like, for the most part, especially to Alexis Bledel's character. Whereas, like, in this new season, in episode one, like, the camera is zoomed in on the most upsetting thing. You know, it's not like you see, like, oh, this person has been hurt now, and you can see from the scar, and they're, you know, or maybe, like, off camera, this person is being hurt, and you can hear them screaming or being upset, or like loud banging or whatever it might be. Like, no, you're watching it. Like, you watch it happen. You know what I mean? And part of that is actually like really good, you know, television, making really good television, like particularly the very first scene of A Handmaid's Tale episode 1 season 2, like that opening sequence, it's about like 10 minutes or so, is really upsetting to watch, but is beautifully filmed and really well done and well produced and edited. Like
except for
every
the music.
Single shot feels powerful. You didn't like the music?
Are we talking about the did you say the first episode where they're in the field?
The first scene of the first episode, yeah.
In the field? Yeah, the music just took me out of it. It's almost like cheesy. Woman's Work was the name of the song, and
oh, I felt it, man.
And it was just sort of like you're watching this horrific thing happen. You're so upset. You can't believe this is really how this is starting. And then all of a sudden, this kind of very light and airy song about, you know, women, a very respectful song about women, I guess, comes on. And it just is so, it just kind of took me out of the moment. And it was like, oh, God.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I can feel that perspective. I also feel like that song, though, like has this quality to it where it's almost like, you know, a woman just crying, you know, like helpless to an extent. And that's not necessarily what the song's about. It's actually kind of about the opposite, but like the idea of, you know, just being really helpless and lost, and it sounds that way. Like there's like the singer actually like makes these whimpering noises throughout the, and it just like, oh man, I was like, yeah, me too, man. Like I also want to whimper, you know, like it was just very, I found it to be pretty powerful. But
well, I guess I'm sort of in between that. I thought it was reasonably effective, but it did feel like a very sort of like before, because that scene is so chaotic and really kind of throws us in the middle of everything. That to me, it was sort of scarier without the music. And then when the music starts, it felt like a more sort of traditional kind of like TV kind of sad or intense scene. And so I didn't mind it, but I think in some ways I wasn't crazy about it, even though I think there were definitely some articles specifically about how great that scene is. And I think it is great, but the music, I don't necessarily think it was like an amazing choice. I thought it was fine.
Do we want to maybe spoiler alert at this point and get into
Sure.
some more of the fine tuning a little bit? So if you have not seen at the very least the first two episodes and do not want to be spoiled, then now's time to say goodbye. We appreciate you listening. We'll see you next week. Come back and listen to the end when you've seen it. See if you agree or disagree and let us know your thoughts. And now we are going to start spoiling. So you've had your obligatory warning time. Spoilers inbound. I want to get back to that airport scene, if we can, for a minute. That to me, like,
that was like one of the scariest scenes, I think, out of all the episodes.
I think so too. And I think like almost anyone can relate to it. And so just, you know, to recap with all of you who either have seen it or don't care to be spoiled, it's Alexis Bledel's character. It's a flashback to her past. As we know, she is gay. She was married and had a son. And her wife was Canadian. So their plan was to escape and use the Canadian passport and the fact that they're married to get out and go to Canada. And they show up at the airport. Like, first moment of relatability, the airport's completely packed. It's like, you know, we've all been in a packed airport before, but not maybe in an emergency situation where we're like evacuating, you know, a crisis. Totally terrifying, the idea of so many people trying to fight through an airport to get out and to get to safety. And then, you know, they're going through and they have this first check, and they talk to these officers and say, oh, well, you know, you're not flying together. And they're like, no, we're a family. You know, we're married. I had the kid. This is my wife. He's like, oh, okay, just, you know, here's two tickets for the wife and the kid, and yours is a conditional ticket because you have to go check in with someone else, but it should be fine. Don't worry about it. You know, and like, that's the first moment of like doom, I think, or second moment of doom. And then they finally get over to this officer and he's like, no, that is, you know, that's not valid. Like, it's your marriage.
Right, you're not married.
You're not married. That's what he says. You're not married. it's against the law. It's forbidden. And she says, well, what law? And he says, the law, you know, and you're like, holy shit. I think for like anyone who has a partner, anyone who has a kid, like forget the gay part, because the gay part definitely hit home for me. It was very scary. But like even beyond that, I think the idea of like being separated in a situation like that, and also trying to keep your cool for the kid, you know, they're both holding back tears and trying to smile at the kid, and they're being separated. It's just, it is heart-wrenching. It's truly heart-wrenching, especially knowing what we know and knowing what Alexis Bledel goes through following that, is just, it guts you. It really does.
Well, I think it also taps into that, at least, I mean, I think probably everyone has slightly different feelings about sort of when they see, you know, a police officer, and particularly a really seriously armed police officer, but like, it sort of like points to like this sort of weird double-edged feeling, at least that I personally will feel like, which is that on the one hand you think, oh, they're there for my safety, and, you know, particularly in the context of thinking about like terrorism or things like that, like, yes, I am glad that we live in a society with like a, you know, a functioning police force, but also the knowledge that force can be turned against you. And so like in that, you know, scene where that ostensibly it's just like a regular sort of airport security check, but the way it escalates and the way they sort of assert dominance over her is just like, again, like feeling like, oh, this is just a few steps removed from reality. And, you know, frankly, I think that some people who've had to go through, you know, current, airport security checks have experienced something that maybe not identical, but like gets pretty close to that.
Yeah, you already feel so helpless in airports these days, where anybody at any time could kind of, you know, hold you back or say you need to be searched further or check your papers more thoroughly, that you, I think everyone who's traveled can kind of relate to that feeling of you're completely, you have no control over the situation. And it kind of puts you in that moment to the extreme. You know, it's the worst case scenario of having no control over, you know, over trying to just get on an airplane and go somewhere. It's completely up to them. And yeah.
So there's some other scenes that were upsetting for probably other reasons, not necessarily because they were relatable, but just because they were fucking upsetting. In the first episode, we go through three traumatic experiences, like pretty much back to back. We've got the episode opens with a mass hanging, or a fake mass hanging, because they don't actually get hung, but they pull them into Fenway Park. I love the little like hints toward the past world. You know, they bring them into Fenway Park, put them up on platforms, and essentially go through all the motions of we're about to hang you, just to scare the living shit out of all the handmaids. And that was really upsetting. I mean, the moment where the girl next to her pees herself is just like one of those things where I was just like, hold there, they think they're gonna die, you know. It's just very, can you imagine? You can't imagine, you know. Then we see them continuing to be punished in the school, it looks like, right? Doesn't it look like they're in a school?
Yeah, because they were in a cafeteria at one point.
And the punishment there is gruesome as well. And then Offred escapes, I guess, and cuts her ear tracker out, and they filmed,
oh god,
that,
yeah, that was the
thing,
worst.
Too.
Oh yeah, man.
Yeah, I covered my eyes because I was like,
I couldn't look
that.
At it. Maria saw it.
I screamed at the television.
It's a lot of blood in your ear, apparently, too.
Oh,
she
yeah,
was
man.
Drenched.
Oh god, but you gotta give it to what's that actress's name? Anthony,
Elizabeth.
Everybody. Elizabeth Moss. Man, she is.
She's so good.
A god. She is so good. You know.
Isn't it weird that she's a Scientologist, though?
Oh god, I didn't know that. Don't ruin
it. I'm sorry. Them. It's just like, how can you be in this show about like a dangerous cult taking over America and separating families, and yet you're in a dangerous cult in America that's separating families?
See, I think my understanding is that she basically a few years ago was like, all right, like, I'm not going to, like, really talk about my relationship with Scientology, which could mean that she's still 100% in and just doesn't talk about it because it's bad PR. or that, like, she's, like, you know, a little bit more drifted apart and, like, just isn't necessarily highlighting that. I choose to believe the latter, even though I have no evidence for that, but just because I think it would really bum me out if I knew for sure that she was, like, a hardcore Scientologist.
Love your optimism. That's cool.
Well, and, like, we know that it's just another tangent, but we know Scientology, like, uses your secrets against you, you know what I mean? So it's, like, kind of one of those...
Or she may have family in Scientology, and if so she speaks out against it, she won't be able to have a relationship.
Exactly.
With them, so.
Like, we don't know what's at stake if that's the situation.
It's still weird. Okay.
I think we can all agree that Scientology is fucking weird, but maybe not all of us, but I can.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I live near the headquarters for Scientology.
All right. Well, if you get into trouble after this episode, luckily we're doing this really late in the episode, so the Scientologists have stopped listening.
Yeah. They didn't want to be spoiled for season two.
Oh, the other thing about the beginning, the episodes where everyone's being tortured, I want to point out is that the auntie, what's her name? Aunt Linda?
Right? Aunt Lydia.
Aunt Lydia. She says to her something along the lines of, you know, it's really easy. Well, not easy for you, but like, you can call out and you can protest because you know nothing's going to happen to you because you're pregnant with the baby. And so you're not really putting yourself at risk, are you? And I thought that was really powerful too, because whether intentionally or not, it's true. Like, she was at less risk of repercussion at the time that she was acting out than the other girls, because she was caring, you know, she was with the child and they're not going to harm the child.
Well, and I think that speaks again to the idea of, like, expanding June, right? Like, as a character, because she never said that explicitly, but I think we all knew the moment that she got pregnant, she had a 9-month window to kind of make some noise, you know what I mean? And stir the pot. And I think we all knew that that was coming. And Aunt Lydia crystallized it for her. She called her out on it, you know what I mean? Which I don't know if June was doing for herself, which is, you've got nothing to lose, you know, like, for 9 months, you're safe and dandy and, you know, you can keep acting out and we really can't do anything to you. But did you ever think of your friends? Did you ever think of anyone else? And that just kind of builds on the idea of, like, June is not perfect. She's not, like, a heroine necessarily. She's not, like, just this sweet, good, only cares about doing what's right for everyone, in making everyone's lives better. Like, that's not her mission right now. Her mission is, one, to survive, two, to get her kid back, and three, to get the hell out of there. We're showing a little bit, because, you know, did you guys see the episode with her mom?
Yeah. Her mom was a big feminist, and she would go to protests, and she was kind of disappointed in June because June didn't really follow that same path. She was, like, working at a book publisher.
Right. So we are getting a little bit spoily if you have not seen episode 3, which is pretty much impossible unless you're a member of the media. But there is, like, a little bit of background information where her mom, you know, clearly wants her to be the kind of person that fights for everyone, not just herself. And June struggles with that too, I think. You know, like, she has to make choices, like, Do I lead the rebellion, or do I just try to cut and run, you know? And I think that'll be explored more and more the further we get in the season. Like, what will be June's decision? I think that eventually she'll have the opportunity to either do something big in service of the resistance or escape. And what decision she makes will probably determine, you know, the direction of the show as a whole, I think.
I think that also speaks to, like, there's kind of a related issue that I was thinking a lot about in that first episode, which is about sort of the most meaningful forms of resistance, because I think both in the flashbacks and then specifically with June in the, you know, and her interactions with Aunt Lydia, is that there are sort of small rebellions, right, where Aunt Lydia tells her to eat and she refuses to eat.
Or even when she smiles at her, you know? Like, I love the moments where Aunt Lydia is saying something and June just smiles. And it's just so badass. I'm just like, man, you're brave. But right. Go on. Sorry, Anthony.
Yeah, no. And then when you imagine yourself in that situation is that at least that when I'm always thinking about, when I'm thinking about that, I think, okay, well, I would be the kind of person to keep your head down. And then like when there's a chance to do something really meaningful, whether that's meaningful for yourself, like escaping, or meaningful in a larger sense, that's what you're saving yourself up for. But at the same time, you know, the machine, right, depends on that. That the idea of if everyone just kind of goes along with it and you imagine that, okay, well, I'm waiting for my moment, then I think it's very easy to sort of like not put up any meaningful resistance at all. So I kind of like went back and forth in terms of like should you, like when June refuses to eat, is that just her being sort of like petulant and taking advantage of something she can get away with? Or is that also in some way a meaningful way of pushing back? And I don't have an answer. I just thought that like that episode really made me think about that.
Yeah, I think those meaningless, you know, kind of revolutions, I guess, or whatever, you know, like when she fights back without any meaning, it gains its significance by having an audience, right? Like when those things happen in front of other handmaids, that's one thing. When it happens just between her and Aunt Lydia, I don't know how valuable those things are, you know? Like, you're clearly just fueling the power of this woman who will probably kill you, you know, once you have your baby. It's looking that way. So I don't really know, man. I don't know, but that's a great question.
I've watched all the way up through episode 4, and I think, without spoiling anything, I think we're getting a better sense of Aunt Lydia's motivations. I'd love a backstory for her.
Me
honestly.
Too. I keep wondering, like, at one point, June and Aunt Lydia were sitting across from each other, and all I could think was, why isn't June just say, like, how did you get this way?
Yeah, I think she really does believe she's trying to save these women. You know, she's trying to save their souls, so to speak. And all her cruelty is because she truly believes they're, you know, bad, evil, whatever. And that
she's doing right by them.
And that she's doing right. And even all the terrible things she does, which some of which are just absolutely devastating by the 4th episode, that it's about teaching a lesson. You know, learn from this. Learn to be the good handmaid. And, you know, instead of being executed.
Well, I think she also believes that if she wasn't there, it would be even worse for them. And I think in some ways that's actually true, that like there are times where she sort of steps in and then there's horrible shit that happens, but that implicitly, like, maybe even crazy, you know, that they would have all just been executed before now if not for her.
Well, why would they execute all the fertile women, though?
That's true. They probably wouldn't have been. But I think that threat sort of like looms over, and that she has this conversation with that I don't, again, not to say that I think she's a good, but like that she part, I think her point of view is like she has this conversation with June in that first episode where she says, do you think you did something good by like not stoning this other handmaid? I mean, she's going to get sent to the colonies where it's going to be even worse. So, and I think that's like, you know, obviously a crazy and horrible way to look at the world. But I think like it sort of speaks to her own perspective, which is that, you know, I think in some ways she does see herself not just as the guardian of the morality of these women, but also a guardian of their safety to an extent. I mean, she only does so much. I mean, she also does a lot of horrible shit. But that it's like, I think part of the way I'm again speculating here a little bit, but part of the way she rationalizes it to herself is by like, well, I have to be this way because if I'm not, somebody else is going to be here doing that.
Well, and also I think that, like, and we don't know yet because we really haven't gotten a deep dive into Aunt Lydia and kind of what she was before all this, but to be the one looking after these handmaids, right, like to be the one kind of in charge of all that, if you think about it, the brainwashing for them has to be tenfold because handmaids are really the ones who can cause the revolution. They're the ones who can't really be killed, right? They can't be executed on the spot. And because of that, keeping them in line means breaking them far more than maybe someone else, right? Because if you're someone else, if you're just like a random person, if you're a Martha or something, you know, like you fuck up, you're going to get shot in the head immediately. So you're not going to fuck up. You're not going to mess around. Whereas the handmaids know they have some level of power. And so I think Aunt Lydia, in her attempts to kind of break them down, is almost like, if you're not brainwashed, like if you haven't completely given yourself over to this way of life, to this set of rules that we've created, you put yourself in danger, you know? And so that's why I think she can justify being so intense with them, is because the only way to protect them is to keep rebellion completely out of their mind. It's just completely impossible. There's no reason to do that, you know? And that's why a lot of what she says, you're so lucky. You're so blessed, you know? You guys are the luckiest girls in all the land, you know?
They're not in the colonies. Yeah.
Yeah, like you live a good life. You have these, you know, houses you live in. You're treated well. You're cared for. Aside from the monthly rape, you know.
Aside from that, everything's great. Yeah.
You know, and she just tries to kind of, you get to carry life, you know, like you, the God's miracle is living within you, whatever the hell she says, you know. Try to make it seem like a pretty cushy lifestyle that they have, you know. We might make you stone your friend later today, but other than that, you should be happy, you know. And Aunt Lydia and Dowd with that character, and you know, Aunt Dowd plays some characters that are, she is fantastic, man. Her work in The Leftovers was so good.
Yeah,
so
I'm catching
good.
Up in The Leftovers now, and it's, yeah, she's amazing.
She's amazing in The Leftovers. This feels very similar to that, with obviously some differences, but the way that she's able to go to scare you with the tone that she uses, like, oh, come on, dear, please drink up, you know, the baby's hungry, you know, and you're just like terrified by that. Like, she's just a deer and baby, and I'm terrified. How does she do that? And that's like, that's 100% credit to that actress, Aunt Dowd. She's just a baller.
Jordan, I like that you've been working on your Aunt Lydia voice, too.
Well, man, she's in it. She's in my head. I'm pretty sure I dreamt of her last night. Like, she's there. She's working.
I still think it's weird, though, that they're attempting to just brainwash a bunch of women into being handmaids. I mean, I guess this is the book I have an issue with, but, you know, if fertility was such a huge issue, why aren't they just doing IVF and just forcing them to have multiple babies to, like, save the human race, you know? Why this month, only having sex once, isn't it once a month with the commander,
yeah,
or whatever.
It's when you're ovulating once a month or whatever, I mean, ceremony. You're right. There are a lot, but there are tons of inconsistencies. So like they say the problem is like, oh, the earth is dying because we, like, you know, too much carbon emissions and all that stuff, but everybody's still driving around in cars, right? Like it was very pick and choose regime, right? Of like what, they still drink alcohol. You're telling me that like a woman has to wear like wings and her hair up and a freaking robe to be modest, but men can still go around and drink alcohol and shoot skeet or whatever. What do they shoot?
And go to whorehouses.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think Jezebel's is fully like on the record with the regime, but yeah, like the ability to pick and choose what stays and what goes. Like there are no magazines, there are no pretty colors, but like it's fine to have like chandeliers and stuff, you know. Like I don't understand. It's very it's definitely not, like, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. If like the problem is X, like the answer should be Z, but the answer is not Z, it's Y, you know what I mean? Like, it's very,
I mean,
confusing.
One thing that worries me is that, you know, liberals or progressives watch it and get this sort of impression that the Gideon regime or whatever is Gilead, that was a G word, is representative of like what like modern day conservatives actually want. And I think that's only true to some extent. I think, you know, things like maybe the taking away people's rights or whatever is one thing, but I think the idea that a man would take a handmaid and force her to have sex is not really representative of Christian, like conservative Christian values at all.
No, and I think there's a misunderstanding among most liberals that conservatives care more about social issues than they actually do. Like at the end of the day, I would say most conservatives care more about just the money, right? Like, do I get to keep my money or not? And all the factors that play into that money, more so than they care about most social issues. That's not saying all conservatives don't care about, you know, gay rights or immigration or abortion, because there are definitely conservatives out there who do care about those things deeply. But yeah, I think that's a misunderstanding. It's not as much about a social issue as it is about, financially speaking, you know, where the taxes go and why.
Well, I think there's elements of, I mean, and like different kinds of conservatism, which run along different kinds of religious and regional lines as well. But I think like also to one of the earlier points you were making was that one of the things the show does is it suggests the ways in which, you know, some of these, like the ways that we treat the handmaids are arguably a response to this broader crisis in fertility. But the way that changes in the world intersect with religion and ideology is very complex. And so it's not that we're just going to have this purely rational response. It's like a thing that's there's a necessity, but then you create a sort of like justification for it. And then there's all these other pressures going on. So I think like you could argue that some of the stuff is unrealistic or inconsistent, but I think you could also argue that that's what society is there's a lot of things where you're just like, oh, that doesn't make sense. Why the hell did we do that? And that's just, you know, the way it works.
Yeah, it was like a compromise, essentially, right? Like, the scientists are like, oh, we really need to reduce carbon emissions in order to keep the planet healthy and keep women fertile. And the religious right was like, yeah, but also God's pissed because they're all sluts. And it was a little mind meld, you know, in the middle there where it was like, well, let's make them less slutty and let's also work on the emissions and figure out, you know, let's see if we can fix it that way. And, I think that you're absolutely right about that. It's like, everything's layered, right? Everybody has to get their win. And this is the same thing that's happened in politics today, you know? You get like one good law that gets layered in with a bunch of silly, you know, and stupid and useless amendments to make, you know, 20 people happy instead of, you know, necessarily what makes the most sense. So
I still want to know if like the regime somehow managed to take over the like entire like Midwest, Texas, California, you know, all at the same time, because they really didn't show any of that even when they were showing, you know, them blowing up like the White House or whatever.
Well, and part of it is we don't know the state that the world was in before that, because obviously there's an issue with like food production. Like the colonies exist somewhere, right, within the U.S. Like what's going on with them? Like are they actually dangerous to be in? Like it seems like you wouldn't put E. coli in water just to make that place miserable, right? So like there's a reason why there's space within the U.S. where the colonies are dangerous, treacherous territory for whatever reason, factories, whatever else.
There were nuclear explosions there.
Right.
It's radiation. That's what's killing them. And it's in the water.
Right? Okay. Well, yeah, there's also E. coli in the water.
Okay, because she says that in the second episode, but it's also implied that she kind of lied to that character. So it's not 100% clear.
That's 100% true. So we don't know. That's the point, I think, is like as the show expands, I think we'll learn more and more about that. But we don't know the state that the country was in before Gilead rose. We also don't know which people were on board with that and which one were forced, right? Like there obviously was a critical mass of people who agreed that this should be the way that things happen. It wasn't like there was 10% of the population was like, this is how we're going to do things. And there's obviously enough people to keep it in line nationwide, right? And where did those people come from? We don't know.
It kind of hints at a growing like neoconservative movement even before the regime like took power. Like when her child was in the hospital and then they started questioning her about her parenting abilities. You know, oh, you work full time. And there was that implication that that's not something a woman and a mother should do.
Well, is there anything else we wanted to talk about, or should we wrap it up? Well, before we end the episode, let me remind our listeners that they can subscribe to the Original Content Podcast on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app. We're basically everywhere. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. And Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. We'll be right back.